I have had this idea that we need an information pyramid the same way that we have a food pyramid, right? And that we need to think about all of the information that we consume, like every piece of information that comes into our brains, the same way that we think about food nutrition.
You're listening to St. Pete X. Today's episode is brought to you by Cityverse. Cityverse brings the community together on a new civic platform powered by Catalyst News. St. Pete Cityverse is launching soon. You can learn more and reserve your home space at cityverse.life. Now, enjoy the conversation. Joining me today is Kelly McBride, who's a senior vice president at the Poynter Institute, is also a public editor at NPR, and the chair of the Craig Newmark Center for Ethics and Leadership. It's a lot of stuff.
Got a lot of titles.
So let's start, before we dig into topics about news, media, consumption, the business and all that, what's an average day look like for you? So we just sort of level set what you're doing on a day-to-day basis.
Oh, man. Okay. So an average day... I get up and work out almost every morning, and I check in with my brother who lives with me. He's developmentally disabled. He's the bagger at Rollin' Oats, Tim McBride.
He's a superstar.
Many of you know him. I used to be known for all those titles, and now people are like, "Oh, you're Tim's sister." It's like, yes, that is my claim to fame. So I get him off one way or another, and around 8:30 or so, I either from home or from my office at the Poynter Institute, open up both of my laptops, one for NPR, one for Poynter. And I juggle both of those jobs throughout the day. I may be working on writing something. So I'm doing reporting, interviewing people. I may be working on building out curriculum that mm-hmm. I'm using in Poynter's teaching. That's a lot of creative work too. And then I may actually be teaching. And a lot of times I will not even be here in St. Pete. I will be elsewhere also and on the road doing teaching work. It's a lot.
It's a lot. I enjoyed a great couple of days when you brought a crew in to talk about AI and ethics and journalism. And now you're taking that to New York in the near future too.
We just did it.
Actually,
it was just last week. Yeah.
How'd it go?
It was great. AI is a technology that's moving very fast, and there is a wide degree of disagreement among journalists about how transformational it's going to be, and a wide degree of cynicism and hope, right? Mm-hmm. So like some journalists think it's not going to be transformative at all. Some think it's going to be really transformative, but in like a horrible way, and that journalism's just going to get screwed over by technology. And some people think that it's really going to offer some opportunities.
Yeah, it's funny with these new transformative technologies. I remember very clearly when blockchain came around, there was nobody that hated blockchain more than financial advisors age 40 or older, because mm-hmm. This was their whole identity and life was wrapped up into this traditional monetary sort of way of doing things, and then this disruptive trustless, non-governed way of doing things just threatened that. And so they were very, bearish on it and didn't like it. I gave a talk to a group of bankers, and man, it was just like, it reminded me like the old Roman days when they were just, were shouting and off with their heads and, that kind of thing. But so yeah, it's tough when you're in it and it threatens you, which is actually sort of apropos to some of the stuff we may talk about today, is how our own personal interests inform our perspectives, which also inform, how we absorb our content. And you mentioned working out in the morning, which is working on your physical health and your sort of body diet. How about your mind diet? It's a concept you've been working on with regard to news.
Yeah, I have had this idea that we need an information pyramid the same way that we have a food pyramid, right? And that we need to think about all of the information that we consume, like every piece of information that comes into our brains, the same way that we think about food nutrition. So like social media is junk food, right? It might lead you to better food, but for the most part, it's junk food because of the way that you consume it, right? You consume it. You're usually, when you're on social media, you're looking for a little dopamine hit of some kind, right? It's like, show me that funny Instagram video or that cute TikTok dance or whatever. So you're looking for something that's just going to move you a little bit. But you're not necessarily working toward a goal most of the time when you're on social media in terms of information. That's not always true. Breaking news might be a little different when there's something that you really, huge that you really need to know about. But even then, you want to get to a point where you're getting information that is both nourishing and restorative, and some information is good for making you smarter. Some information is good for politically engaging you. Some information is just like standard carbs, right? Like you're just going to get through your day with this information, but you need it, right? Like what the weather is, or maybe the air pollution, or whether there's a hurricane bearing down on you, right? And so I do think that, and I really want to do more research on this. If anybody out there has a grant that they would like to give me, I think I need about $1.5 million to do all this research. But I really want to build a food pyramid for our information ecosystem. And I know you're really into like the local ecosystem. And I think that's going to be the hardest one, right? Because locally, doesn't matter what market you're in, you might have a lot of choices, but and some of them might be healthy, but they may not suit your style of consuming information. So locally, I think it's really difficult.
Don't get your information from a drive-thru, essentially, which is like
exactly right.
Yeah, and I think one of the challenges is how news gets wrapped into serving other needs. So, you could say some of it is the low value carbs and sugar. But you also mentioned other emotional needs that information can serve. And sometimes the news can serve those even in a positive way, but it's still a colored way. It's a flavored perspective or whatever. One interesting, variable rewards are such a driver, for people that it actually usurps the information need. And, there was a famous experiment that was done where they had, and this goes back to our, caveman days where you'd go out and hunt and only come back 1 out of 10 times successfully from the hunt. And so your survival, essentially when the hunters came back, that was like almost a slot machine. Did I come back with a losing, bet, or did I come back with a jackpot? And they did an experiment where they had rats in a cage and they could press a button and get a treat. And 100% of the time, treat would come out. And the rats would press it, whatever, 6 times, 8 times an hour and eat a normal number of treats. Then they just randomized it. So a treat would come out every third time, every eighth time. They weren't sure. And it kicked a completely different part of the brain into gear. And they started pressing the button hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times just because of the rewards were made variable. And essentially, this is what a slot machine is. You press it and it rolls and you win some, you don't. And that's kind of what social media is. It actually mimics a slot machine as you doom scroll. It's like crap post, crap post, crap post, very interesting posts. And that's like the mini jackpot. And that's what spikes the dopamine because you're getting those relative interesting things as you scroll through the non-interesting things.
Yeah. And when you do that, there's an opportunity cost, right? Mm-hmm. Because you only have so many hours in a day to consume media. And we basically, as humans, have really ramped up how much media we consume. It's way more than anybody thought was possible. But we are maxing out, right? It's somewhere around, for some people, like 12 hours a day. It's a lot of media. But if you were to, and like some people's phones give them like, here's what you spent your time on. But even like my phone is like, oh, look, you spent like 4 hours on the New York Times. And it's like, yeah, that was a really hard wordle. Right? Like I was not doing anything that was, that was really good for me. Like I was doing the mini crossword or something like that. And so, we don't have a really good way of truly even monitoring our own media consumption. And we don't have like a blood test to tell us like how much we're, how well we're doing or how badly we're doing. And I do think that there is this feeling of disconnect that might be the blood test, right? Mm-hmm. This feeling that, especially if you think about your local community. And I've lived in St. Pete since 2002, right? So I've lived here for a long time. I raised all my kids here. My parents live here. I should feel really, really connected to this community. But most of my work is not here, right? Most of my work is with companies that are outside of St. Pete. And there are times when, like, I have a really hard time understanding the community that I live in and just how much it's changed. Because it has changed dramatically. And I don't know how to get there, right? Yeah. Like, I don't know what to do to feel more connected to our community. And I've done all these things, right? Like I started this little bowling nonprofit for people with special needs, right? And I like hang out with a group of athletes and I try and do like local athletic events and stuff like that. Like I try and follow my own interests that would connect me to other people, but I still feel like I get in a bubble and like I do not understand truly what my community is all about and where I live and who my neighbors are.
Yeah. And I wonder how much of that is just simply it being squeezed down by, you know, competing interests. I mean, I look at the paper, the local paper, which still exists, but, you know, has gone more, a little more national. And the content experience on there is not as good from, you know, for our previous conversation about dopamine or whatever. And so the content experience was better on social, so people gravitated to these national platforms, which weakened the binding agent of our communities, and had them spending more time on the, you know, Kardashians and things like that than they have on local equivalent. And I don't know if that will ever come back. I mean, I don't know. And, you know, and the only thing to me that could bring that back was an equally compelling content experience that also had the additional value prop of being real life local that, you know, gave you that additional value that something national couldn't. But it seems now that that's, you know, that doesn't, the dopamine piece of it, the social piece of it, the more interesting things. And I think, you know, ultimately they're just, the whole world is more interesting as a whole than local is interesting as a whole.
Yeah. And I mean, the problem with that is, you know, that a lot of that pop culture stuff that's really interesting that you follow compulsively is a manufactured reality, right? And like, you can't really do that with local because you live here, right? Like you would know that like that's a manufactured reality. And so you wouldn't be able to do that, right? It's like, so the reason that we love that, those national narratives are because they're not completely real, right? They're pretty trite and pat and manufactured. And I don't know, like, so that, I don't think that would ever work, right? And so it's possible that we've just ruined ourselves, right? And that we've ruined our ability to really connect locally.
Yeah, I mean, it's a cold, stark, big batch of work to do to craft that reality versus having a really comfortable, attractive, interesting one spoon fed to you. So I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, like I have this great neighbor group and we do dinners together every 6 weeks or so.
What do you talk about?
I mean, yeah. Do we talk about what's going on in St. Pete? No. A lot of times we talk about national stuff. We talk about our kids. But yeah, we don't talk about like the local community much, even though we all have jobs. I mean, like everybody else has a job. No, that's not true. Actually, that's the other thing is, you know, I guess about half of my neighbor group have jobs where they actually work. They're remote workers. Mm-hmm. They actually work for a national company or like they don't even go into an office here.
Yeah. Interesting.
Isn't that? I mean, man, that I hadn't even occurred to me until right then. I wonder if our ability to work elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, if it's into a larger, just the dispersing of our attention nationally.
And then our severed brains, right? Like, that's where we are. We're at work.
Yeah. And to your point with it, it's one thing you can say if someone's eating, McDonald's nonstop, you're going to be able to look at them and see that. But what's a little more insidious about your information diet is a lot of times if you don't even know it's happening to you, right? It all just sounds normal because, your friends on Facebook or wherever are kind of seeing the same information and feeling the same way as you. And I'll see that a lot, when you see like people coming out and just believing that there's a basement in the pizza place in Washington with, a pedophilia dungeon or whatever. The place doesn't even have a basement, but there are, people that were compelled enough that was true enough to them that they took a gun to the place, right? And there are just thousands of people in these groups. And so it almost takes to have a truly, I think if there were going to be a diet check or a blood test, it would have to be some sort of third party objective thing that can sort of be outside of your peer bubble, because a lot of times you get that, that group think and just tacit acceptance of that a reality because you're all eating the same food.
Yeah. And I do wonder about physical spaces versus virtual spaces. I am frequently in physical spaces where people don't agree with me, mm-hmm. right? Like, and people have a variety of viewpoints, but I bet that's a lot less than it used to be. And part of that is my own choices that I've made, right? That
I think you're a unique animal in that regard, that you are in places by your job and by choice that do challenge that.
Yeah, but it's less than it used to be, right? And I think, I don't know, I think it's harder now. It's really hard. It's like we're almost wary of being in a space with people who have different opinions. I mean, part of it is, so I have noticed this a lot in my work. People can be really rude and nasty online, right? There's this coarseness, and we see it now in a lot of the way our politicians interact with each other. And sometimes people are like that. It didn't used to be that they would bring those behaviors. But a couple of times I've been on planes, and when people hear that I am a journalist, like, they just lay into me. And like, I had this one guy recently who believed that the mainstream media, he saw, I actually took it off because I didn't want this to happen again, but I had an NPR button on my backpack. And he was like, oh, are you a donor to NPR? And I was like, well, I am actually donor to NPR, but I'm also I work at NPR. And he started quizzing me, and I could pretty quickly tell that he was doing like a legitimacy check. Like, he was asking me what universities I went to, and then he mentioned these universities that he was affiliated with, which were these sort of rather newish universities that had recently been founded to create a whole other narrative about what a university should be. And he just kept wanting to argue with me about everything. And I finally was like, and this was not a lie. I was at the time judging a podcast contest. And I was like, I'm judging a podcast contest. I have like 20 podcasts to listen to between now and tomorrow when I have to have a meeting. So I'm going to put my headphones on and listen to these podcasts. But I also just did not want to be in an argument because I didn't even know what we were arguing about.
Well, and I think that's, again, another one of the insidious aspects of going to national platforms is that there's a lot of energy built up, but there's really no place for it to go. And so, you can't personally affect an outcome in the Ukraine or on some of these national issues. And so with this energy, the only outlet, the only satisfaction, the only sort of feeling of validation and I'm aliveness you can get is to defeat somebody else in a verbal sparring match online. And, that's the way a lot of these conversations go. And so that's become a craft in and to itself, because it's literally the only place in my mind for a lot of that energy to go. And so repeat that for 10 years, and it's inevitable that I will spill over into in-person interactions, because it's become such a fabric of 80% of their lives is spent doing that, you know, on the
internet. We should start, you know, there are these movements, like one is called Better Angels, and they are these movements to deliberately bring people together in mm-hmm. physical spaces where they can relearn the skills of just talking to somebody to understand what their perspective is rather than talking to somebody to defeat them. Mm-hmm. We should start one of those here.
There is one, actually.
Is there?
Yeah, there's a startup that was doing that, and I can't remember the name off the top of my head. I'll try to include it in the show notes, but it was a couple years ago. I don't know where it's gone since then, but it was, and it actually was like a public environment where they'd have two people, and it was meant to be a civil discourse and then to have sort of a networking opportunity after that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unfortunately the people who would agree to participate in that are probably generally thoughtful people anyway, who would be the most susceptible for it being successful. You know, it's the people that wouldn't even do that or, you know, but maybe they would come in just to fight.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there is a benefit in practicing it because I feel like I'm getting out of practice.
I think that we had with the internet, a bloom of information so that if you had a passion, you know, I think about the rabbit holes I go down on YouTube, right? And the stuff I'm really into that I feel like an expert on because I just watch it, you know, professional pickleball, right? So like I know everything that's going on in professional pickleball and I don't know anything that's going on in professional tennis, right? And so that's my perspective. But to the neighbor who thinks pickleball is noisy and hurts the neighborhood and things like that, and they're living that deeply themselves, you know, we're going to have two very different but very valid perspectives. And then mixing those two, you know, my first sort of hurdle would be what's the motivation? Why do I need to spend my energy, you know, in this busy world to mix, you know, to try to come together with that person who owns the house across the street from the pickleball? There's just, you know, a lot of people with a lot of very embedded perspectives and each one of them is almost like a Mount Everest to climb to, you know, to gain any kind of common ground. And when you have a busy, busy, full life, you know, a lot of times people just opt out of even trying.
Right, because nobody models it for us, right? Like it's not that you need to convince the person who lives next to the pickleball courts and no longer can have their windows open,
right?
That they should just suffer for the common good of all these pickleball players who want to get their game in before 9 o'clock in the morning when they have to go to work.
Yeah. Guilty.
Yeah, I know you are. I see you down there. But I mean, you know, because that's not the goal. The goal is just to be more aware, right? And just to be aware that like, oh, this phenomenon of all these people playing pickleball, that other people experience it in a very different way. And we particularly don't like... We don't like to listen to people who are suffering, right? And sometimes it's because we want to invalidate their suffering, like whatever. It's, you know, there's 40 people out here having a great time and there's, you know, 3 people in your house who have to get up earlier than they want to because the pickleball is making so much noise. And sometimes it's just because suffering is unpleasant, right? And like just acknowledging that. And there are varying degrees of it. It's easy to talk about, you know, the neighbor to the pickleball court because it's a mild form of suffering. But I can tell you from, you know, I created this, you know, very small nonprofit called Saturday Bowling with Friends. And when I talk to people about how difficult it is for people with special needs to really find a place where they can be comfortable. People want the feel-good part of it, but they do not want to acknowledge that like we have created a world that is inaccessible to a lot of people, and they cannot live a full and satisfying life because of the world that we've created. And, you know, and I'm always like, as I'm trying to get volunteers and donations, I'm always like, you know, we owe our neighbors something, in this. But people don't like that argument. And I've discovered that is not a good way to get volunteers or donations. The better way to get volunteers and donations is to be like, look how happy this is. Look how much happiness we're creating. Look how much joy we're creating. So people like to think about the positive things, but they don't, unless it's their own anger and their own suffering, they don't really want to delve into.
Well, and that's, you know, that's the other byproduct of this proliferation of expertise, because there's also expertise in suffering. Because, you know, for every person who can make a case for special needs folks, there's people that will make a case that's compelling for LGBTQ, for the environment, for animals, you know, and for all sorts of things that are all equal, you know, that are all true. And, you know, to a general person, it's, you know, once you open Pandora's box of, you know, being, you know, wanting to delve into the world of suffering to cure some of it, it's essentially endless. It can consume you. And so therefore it's the people who are directly affected by it that are the champions for it, because they're willing to go deep into that one realm. And then they leverage their connections, friends, and general prowess as a, you know, operating human to help make a, you know, to make that piece better. But I think that's an age, you know, an age old struggle that will probably, you know, only get more complex as actually the awareness of different needs continues to, you know, to grow.
Yeah, we sort of lost. There used to be a religious component to it, right? Like you used to be instructed by your religious communities to alleviate suffering, to make the world a better place. And there were all sorts of ways of doing that, tithing and evangelism and simple charity. And we don't, like even the religious communities that I've been involved in don't do a lot of that anymore. And then, you know, and we had sort of turned that all over to the government and said, okay, that's the government's job to do all that. It's going to be interesting to see what we do. I mean, to a certain extent, we are this world of incredible resources, just incredible resources. And yet we have a very hard time sharing them.
Yeah. Well, and you know, case in point, the religious folks are struggling, you know, to not have to sell their churches anymore. And so they have to, you know, it's put your own mask on before, you know, before you help others put their mask on. And a lot of churches don't have masks anymore, you know, and they're just struggling to breathe themselves. So it's changed the nature. They don't have the, you know,
they don't have the congregation.
The base, yeah.
They don't have, yeah, they don't have, yeah, churches, I mean, formal institutions have been on the decline. Yeah. It really does feel like we're at a pivot point though. And that, our connection to our local communities may be the first thing that's going to fall apart.
Yeah. Yes. And what I have hoped for as, you know, the next iteration of wisdom and thinking or leadership is people who can blend perspectives. I think if we got to a world where the person who, you know, there's that, I forget the philosopher who said, or somebody who said, intelligence is being able to hold multiple opposing ideas in your head and make sense of them. The people who can say diplomatically in a, from a trusted position, and this is where I think journalism potentially, you know, could move into this space as well. It's saying, you know, and I think we use an example of offshore drilling before, right? Offshore drilling is an environmental risk. It's a tax asset. It's a corporate asset. It's a national, you know, defense, less reliance on foreign oil.
Source of jobs.
Source of jobs. You know, but it could affect tourism, but it could also fund tourism, right? If it's paying into the tax base. So like there are a lot of sides to offshore drilling that are all very valid and very true. And within each of those sides, there are deep experts who will argue eloquently for from their perspective. And you're stuck in the middle. What you're essentially, you know, have to decide is which of those perspectives is most compelling to you and then move into that one. But at the end of the day, it doesn't negate the other perspectives. And so, you know, perhaps, you know, this post-perspective wisdom is the person who could stand in the middle of all those perspectives and, you know, consolidate them and parse them out in a way that brings everybody to the table, you know, and they're lauded for that, which over time changes what we value as, you know, intelligence and leadership is people who can actually do that. And that, you know, that's maybe solves some of the problems we have today.
So interestingly, I mean, the media landscape, this actually came directly out of the AI, artificial intelligence conference that Poynter hosted last week in New York. So the media landscape is, for the most part, still organized around the unit or the post or the article, right? Like that is how everything is organized. It's how all the workflow is organized. It's how all the delivery systems are organized. There is this concept that as artificial intelligence becomes more sophisticated, that something else will replace that unit, right? So that the unit of information is something else.
Smaller or bigger?
Or bigger. It could be bigger. I don't know. Like what you're talking about is bigger.
Yeah.
But it's possible that it could be even smaller.
Yeah.
It's possible that it could be a nugget of information rather than a point of view.
Right.
It is going to be interesting to see how technology changes that.
And you know, I know this will be met with feelings of unease, but I'm comfortable with it. But I think, you know, this agentic AI, you know, agents that are your sort of, you know, the digital other half of your brain, which I think is an inevitable place that we'll be in a decade or two. They could actually hold that role for you because, you know, by definition, they're parsing information. Obviously you have to look at the underlying logic and data in, data out and all that sort of thing. But really it's, you know, with all the complexities of, you know, trusting other humans and being able to be that, you know, that sort of parser of information across many different ways. Like, I think we have that now in a bad way with like people looking up to media personalities and things that just say, interpret the world for me because it's too much, right? And I'll just believe what you think, right? And this is where we get these sort of streamlined, you know, it's almost like religion again, where you can just fall into an identity and they just tell you how to be, right? But I, you know, I do think there is a world where the AI and that personalized agent that you have can act as that parser and serve that role, but in a way that you feel like you have control over. So you're actually, you know, shaping it and having a one-on-one relationship with it in a way that actually reduces the trust need because you're essentially trusting yourself and thinking of it as a tool to do this for you. So it's like bionic thinking.
Wow. That is so incredibly optimistic.
I know.
I think that, so, right. So the other more likely scenario though is that.
Make sure you shop at Walmart.
Well, or it just like, so in what we're seeing with the AI, with generative AI now is it is this, this sort of drive toward mediocrity, right? And I think like the Google AI is a great example of that, right? Like if you ask Google, if you search for something, you first get an AI generated answer for it. And a lot of times, if you know anything about that subject at all, like if you did anything on pickleball, you would be so dissatisfied with what Google gives you because you would recognize that it was mediocre at best, whatever you were asking. And that's because of the way generative AI works, right? And even when you Like I've even noticed there are a lot of newsrooms that are using generative AI and chatbots around a specific area of expertise, right? Like there's one in San Francisco called Chowbot, right? Mm-hmm. And it's just around restaurant reviews because the San Francisco Chronicle has a fabulous restaurant section. And the Washington Post has one about the environment. And because they have a deep set of environmental reporting. And so even when you limit that, the inputs of what it's scraping to come up with your answer, I find it not satisfying. And one of the things that we discovered in this conference was that there is this longing for the human fingerprint. And it's almost innate, right? Like almost everybody can recognize AI, not completely, and like on the quizzes, sure, because the quizzes are meant to trick you. But like when you are presented with something that comes from AI, it often feels unsatisfying. And the human fingerprint is so much more satisfying. And I think about this even in music curation, right? So my favorite radio station, next to NPR, of course, and WUSF, my favorite radio station is WMNF, right? And I love it because everything they do is human curated, right? And it is just somebody picking music for me to listen to. And I appreciate that so much more now. And I do think that, so I don't know that we're ever going to get there. And I think that if we ever do have that alter ego agent that's going to be AI powered, that's really going to be us, but it's going to be AI powered, I think it's going to be the most mediocre version of us.
I mean, I'm going to respectfully disagree. I think AI is in toddler phase right now. Is just, I mean, the fact that a year ago you couldn't make a decent picture and now you can actually develop a full app that is a beautiful app in 30 minutes, like it's going so fast. And I think the AI, that's why I said in a decade from now, I think the AI in a decade from now will be just an insanely more advanced version of AI than it is now. Yeah, agreed. It's 100% mediocre now, but I also just see that it is a path of least resistance and there's precedent for it. Like, you know, we take a machine and hook it up to our heart and believe what it says, right? And it's like, your heart's healthy, your heart needs this, and we'll cut you open if it says we need to, and we do it. And we go to WebMD, and a lot of people, you know, self-diagnose now for a lot of their issues. And so some tranche of medical stuff, you know, people don't go to doctors for anymore. They just use the internet. The internet's just a rudimentary version of AI.
So
right?
Let me ask you, would you rather go to an AI doctor who's going to be more accurate than your current doctor, but isn't going to be able to explain anything to you in a way that you're really going to understand it? Or would you rather go to a real doctor doctor?
You're baking in weaknesses to the AI doctor. So I would say I would always choose more accurate information and then trust that I'll be able to figure it out. Or even if I can trust the AI and it gives me the most accurate information, I would just do what it tells me. Versus, you know, because again, even when a doctor explains it to you, they're putting things, you know, in terms you kind of understand, but you at a cellular level don't understand what those pills are doing when they put it into you. You know, it's just, you have this and it's these symptoms. And so we give you this and it'll do that. And I feel good about it. But, you know, the hard science behind it is, you know, if I can eliminate human error in diagnosis, I would always personally go for the more accurate diagnoses. Of course, I'd love talking to a doctor more, and I have a relationship with my doctor. And I would also say that one thing I've learned is never make assumptions based on your generational place. Like, you and I are about the same age, and, you know, where we grew up with the family doctor, and I love that and all that things. But, you know, the kids may not care. They're just like, you know, oh, yeah, telehealth, that's what we do, right? And then, you know, next their kids will be like, oh, yeah, AI doctor, that's what we do. And, you know, there's so many things now. Every generation laments, you know, what we lost, you know, when the TV came out, people lamented it. When the internet came out, people lamented it. So I think it's natural for everyone to, you know, look at the juxtapose what their foundations were versus what is now. But we have to remember that the next generation's foundations are this, and, you know, that changes things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're not wrong. I don't know though. When we did that exercise, it was interesting. I think people who've had crappy healthcare would much rather go to an AI doctor, mm-hmm. right? And if you've ever had a difficult diagnosis, yeah, you want to go to the AI doctor. But if you've ever felt like, you know, you've been in a factory,
sure,
you know, for your healthcare, and you're getting, you know, mediocre care from the factory.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the other option. So, you know, in England, we know that, you know, they're notorious for taking 2 to 3 months to get in to see a human doctor. So then the question is, would you rather see an AI doctor in 10 minutes or see a real doctor in 3 months? You know, and now all of a sudden the question, just reframing it that way, may change people's answers.
Yeah, that makes a big difference. Yeah.
So news diet.
News diet. That's what we were talking about.
So let's dig in a little bit. You know, I just, because this is so much a part of what you're doing now, I think we'd be remiss to not talk about it. So obviously there's a lot of cuts being happening. I think Doge is officially a verb now. People are being, you know,
People are being doged.
Yeah. So, you know, as someone who's on the front lines with, you know, obviously NPR and news organizations, what's the state of things?
Well, I mean, Yeah, this current administration does not like the media. That's a headline. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you all about it. The first thing they did was cut USAID, and that work was often supporting democracy in places where democracy is unstable. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was supporting fact-checking and journalism organizations around the world, mm-hmm. right? So that was the first hit. The other thing that they've done is changed how the White House press pool and the Pentagon press pool work. So they have, you know, they sort of kick the AP out of the White House press pool. And I've heard from a lot of people who are really worried about that. Mm-hmm. Because the way the press pool works is you can't have every organization go with the president. So they pick a small group of people to travel with the president. But the AP, because of the nature of what it is, right, this international wire service that serves people all over the country and all over the world, they always had a spot, which meant that they were really good at it. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of concern, and people who see the press pool reports now are worried that they are not as thorough and they are not as complete, mm-hmm. and that the president, especially on the weekends, could do something, have a conversation with somebody, and the press pool would not see the significance of it and would therefore not report it out to the rest of us. And we just never know what happened. Mm. So that is a concern. And then there is also, you know, there have been all these regulatory actions, right, where they have sued various journalists or journalism organizations or attacked their licensing. And then, you know, the FCC has an investigation into several different organizations around their FCC license, which would be for broadcast bandwidth. Including NPR and PBS. And then Congress also is looking at the funding that goes into the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which supports portions of NPR and PBS. And so all of that can create a chilling effect on the media. And we're very much at Poynter trying to work with journalists to help them understand that you don't want to pull back, right? You need to be doing really good observational journalism, mm-hmm. right? You have to report the facts. You have to ask the hard questions. You have to get the documents. You have to dig into what's going on. And so we just today had a webinar that we had like 300 people on it. And it was just, looking at the legal and regulatory threats, and as an individual, what as a journalist you should be doing to insulate yourself so that you can do good work. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but the economic forecast is this comes at a time when obviously the stock market's tanking at this moment. The economy, is looking scary to a lot of people. Journalism has been, and local journalism in particular, has been a really scary economic world for a good 15 years now. So that it's bound to cause further cutbacks in journalism.
And one noteworthy one was Facebook cut their funding, right? Because the fact-checking.
Facebook had been one of the single biggest funders of fact-checking, mm-hmm. right? And it's because they were funding fact-checkers to fact-check things that were on Facebook, and like everything was on Facebook. And so Facebook would pay fact-checking organizations to do fact-checks that they would then supply to Facebook, and Facebook would decide what to do about the content. But yeah, that's gone now. So there's a lot less fact-checking in the world that's being paid for. There's nobody else is stepping up and saying, I'll pay the fact checkers.
Right, right.
And so they're mostly doing it not-for-profit kind of work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I would say that the audience of this podcast is probably 50-50, right? So, mm-hmm. and most people, when I say 50-50, left, right, is what I mean by mm-hmm. 50-50. So
kind of like the country.
Kind of like the country, yeah. And, most people on the left will make constant digs and jokes about Fox News, right? Mm-hmm. And most people on the right will make similar digs about, the WMNFs of the world and just based on demographics. So if we get to a place where a right president, right-leaning president is going to target left-leaning media, left perceived, and I'm not even going to, mm-hmm. you know, perceive left-leaning media. And, you know, eventually the, it's not unlikely that a, you know, a counter to Trump would be a left style, Trump, you know, that's a little more boisterous and whatever, if that's, you know, if that's what's in vogue to be nowadays. He might equivalently look at, you know, excluding Fox News from the, you know, from the pool. So what's, you know, where does that end up? It, you know, is there such a thing as, you know, is there any group that you see that's, you know, that can actually be in the middle, or is it impossible to be in the middle now? Because if you're not on the right, you're left. And if you're not on the left, you're right.
Yeah. I mean, that's a hard question to answer. I think there are a lot of organizations that are painted unfairly with a label, right? And that doesn't mean that there aren't shades in that, but like they're painted the full on, you know, like full on so liberal. And people do that with NPR all the time. And it's like NPR is so incredibly middle of the road. It surprises me, right? That like, oh, that's what you think is liberal, right? And I get it all the time because I'm the public editor, right? So when people complain about NPR being liberal, they usually complain about, they actually don't complain about the political coverage. What they complain about is that NPR talks about race.
Mm.
Now, NPR has a mandate to reflect the country. And the reason that they talk about race is because it's an area that a lot of people are interested in. But the audience, it's really been these political voices and pundits who have created, in my mind, a distortion. And they will pick, they will cherry pick things and say this is representative of NPR's coverage, when my job is to look at NPR's coverage all day, every day, and I don't see that. I do see this, you know, NPR is based in Washington. It's got offices in Los Angeles, got an office in New York. I think those are traditionally liberal places. But it also has this like national network of news organizations. And to the extent that it can lean more on those, like across the network, I think it can actually show the country itself better than any other news organization. But I don't know, back to your question, I mean, it's such a distortion when we talk about the media that I don't even know. Like the Wall Street Journal has always been considered very conservative by journalists. And yet most of the people who hate the media, who hate the mainstream media, would say that the Wall Street Journal is not conservative at all and that they are liberal. And yet editorially, right, their editorial page is super conservative, like let the markets do the market thing. And their coverage is for people who want to know about capitalism, right? And about like why companies are valued the way they're valued. That's essentially who reads the Wall Street Journal. And yet that would be painted as liberal now. So I think that we have a hard time even identifying right now what's liberal and what's conservative. And so that's the problem. Like I think somebody could stand in that space of being right in the middle by a number of different measures, and they would be described as liberal.
Yeah, I mean, and maybe that goes back to who's doing the describing, right? So it's their purpose for making that noise is not actually to get to a middle of the road place. It's to serve their own agenda. So, you know, if you've got restaurant A, no matter what restaurant B's menu is, it has to be unhealthy to serve your purpose at restaurant A. And so no matter how middle of the road they are, how much they have some healthy options and some unhealthy options, you're always going to be harping on the unhealthy options, because you actually don't care about the balanced diet. You care about making your restaurant popular.
Yeah. So you're basically saying that people are disingenuous. And yet I don't think they all are disingenuous, but there are a lot of disingenuous people out there in the media, including even on the liberal side, right? Yeah. Like I do hear from a lot of liberals, consumers of NPR, who are just irate that NPR is as middle of the road as, you know, and they just think it is a travesty. And they often start their letters by saying, I've been donating to NPR for 30 years or 50 years or whatever, and I'm not going to donate anymore because you are enabling this world by being so neutral.
Yeah, I see it how the information is parsed out. You know, when Elon went into Twitter, he kind of went in, and it's the only equivalent I would have to his, you know, efforts with Doge. He immediately cut, 80% of the staff or whatever, and he overcut and caused a lot of turmoil, and people lost their jobs in, you know, unexpected fashions, and there was a lot of misery attached to that. And, you know, that's what the Elon haters talked about. And then the people who thought there was bias and shadow bans, they talked about that. And, you know, Elon went in as a business person, and now we're a year down the road and Twitter's operating functionally. Again, I won't get into whether it's a good platform or not a good platform, but functionally as a business, it's operating at 20% of the staff it had before. And it had some, you know, I'm sure there's some elements of it that are not as good or whatever, but then, you know, it begs the question. So it's like, you know, there were just three, I clearly see three different sets of voices. You know, people looked at it objectively as a business decision and, you know, did it work? You know, are they, has their cost base has gone down by a ton? Are they a healthier business? Yeah, probably. Did they lose those people lose their jobs and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And has it become, you know, has the actual content gone the wrong way? And depending on where you lean, you know, people shouted equally loud about all of those. And, you know, I kind of see the same pattern happening with Doge. And obviously there's much bigger ramifications when USAID gets cut around the world and whatnot, you know. But I would assume from Elon's point of view that he's treating it the same way. He's not coming in ideologically. He's just coming in from the same way. He just, you know, said, hey, and his lever is, again, I can't speak for him, but, you know, from what he said, his lever is the budget, right? That we're trillions, you know, we can't even afford to pay the interest on our loans now. And this is the way out of it. And, you know, people have just reacted very strongly to various elements of what he's done, kind of based on their content diet, what I found.
Yeah. I mean, our job as journalists is just to describe what's happening, right? And that is hard because there are the facts of it, right? Like, so this many people have been cut and this much money has been saved. But even that has been hard to nail down, right? Like, I think journalists have done a really good job fact-checking the Doge charts. But I think there's going to continue just to even accurately describe what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have this problem that you've been describing, which is who's actually interested in that?
Yeah.
Right? Who wants to know that, right? Because what people really want to know is the emotional component of that.
Yeah.
And whether it is a good emotional component or a bad emotional component. And that is the weight that gets attached to every single piece of information now. And it makes the actual information very hard to judge. I've been a journalist for more than 40 years, right? And I don't think I've ever seen this much news need to be documented, right? Like a total remaking of the federal government, two wars, both with nuclear powers involved, all-out reshaping of the international economy on top of it. Hard to imagine that those are not going to have consequences. And then like, and then we're like, yeah, but like, how do I get to know my neighbor? It's like, I don't know, right? Because out there in the stratosphere, there's a lot going on.
Yeah. But hopefully this experiment we have, you know, it's definitely worth fighting for. If you look, you know, if you look at a grand sort of global historical point of view, it's been people in power just grabbing and seizing that power at all, you know, and it's happened in countries that were supposedly advanced and just even in the last decade, incredibly awful things have happened in what you would consider advanced societies because people, you know, seize power. So, you know, this experiment in democracy we've been having for 150 years has been a good one so far, and hopefully we fight to keep it going.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for having me.
I always enjoy talking to you. Kelly McBride, Poynter Institute, NPR, and Craig Newmark, Center for
Saturday Ethics. Bowling with Friends.
Saturday Bowling with Friends.
Don't forget that.